אתם מאזינים ל-SBS בעברית.
As the war in Gaza continues and hopes for a political resolution appear increasingly distant, peace builders, diplomats, and policy experts are continuing to search for practical pathways towards a more secure and just future for both Israelis and Palestinians. Joining us today are two internationally recognized voices working at the forefront of conflict resolution and diplomacy. Hiba Kassas is a Palestinian political strategist, mediator, and coalition builder. She's the founding executive of the Geneva-based Principles for Peace Foundation and convenes Uniting for a Shared Future, a coalition of more than 550 Israeli and Palestinian leaders working towards a shared political future. Also joining us today is Gil Murciano, chief executive of the Mitvim Institute, Israel's leading think tank on regional foreign policy. Dr. Murciano is a foreign policy and security expert whose work focuses on Israel's place in the Middle East, regional democracy, and the prospects for long-term stability and coexistence. He's advised policymakers in both Israel and in Europe and is widely recognized for his analysis of regional security challenges. Lastly, we're also joined by Kate Rosenberg. Kate Rosenberg is the executive director of the New Israel Fund in Australia, the organization hosting the Roadmap to Peace tour. Kate has spent more than 15 years working across human rights, civil society, and community organizations in Australia and Israel. Welcome to the three of you, and thank you so much for joining us here on SBS.
Thank you very much for hosting us.
Thank you, Maria.
The phrase roadmap to peace sounds so hopeful, even idealistic, but many people in this day and age feel very pessimistic, more than ever, actually. What gives all three of you energy and confidence that peace is still possible? And also, what overarching message are you wanting to leave with your Australian audiences whilst you're here in Australia?
Well, thank you very much, Marielle, for hosting us. It's very difficult for many to conceive peace as the outcome of this past 3 years of intense suffering on both sides of the conflict. You know, for Palestinians, and I'm speaking as a Palestinian, you know, both October 7th, the massacre that unfolded on that day, but also the devastating war that followed as well in Gaza and its impact on human lives. And, you know, the majority of the Gazan population today continue to live in tents. There is an, you know, immense sense of loss, and trauma is engulfing both people. So sometimes when we talk about a pathway to peace, people think, you know, what are you talking about? The reality is that we're getting to the conclusion in both societies as pragmatic leaders that the status quo has not been sustainable and is not sustainable. It has not delivered security to the Israelis, nor dignity and self-determination to the Palestinians. Conflict management is, without its resolution, is just not an option anymore. We have to break the cycle, and we need to do it in a pragmatic way and in a realistic way. Today, for both people, as hard as the public opinion is around imagining a two-state outcome, the reality is that mistrust between the two populations is so high that the only way forward is actually separation. But separation, as people who have been following this conflict very closely, who have been shaped by this conflict personally, but also as people who've worked on at the international level and have seen what is possible in other conflicts that were also brutal in impact, whether we're talking about countries like East Timor or the case of the peace process in Aceh, Indonesia, or looking at, you know, the Northern Ireland experience, or looking at Bosnia and Herzegovina, or looking simply at the history of Europe, you do see that it is possible. And the pathway to peace is never from the comfort of the status quo, but it is from the hardest and darkest moments. So that's what gives us hope. It's the sense of possibility and the deep knowledge that it is not from the comfort of the status quo that the peace processes are pursued, but it's actually through the midst of suffering and trauma, and the fact that there is growing realization that there is no military solution to this conflict, only a political solution that realizes the right of both people for self-determination, independence, statehood, safety and security and dignity is the sustainable and right outcome for both people to break the cycle of intergenerational trauma.
Hibbert, some would say that the premise of your comparison to other countries in building peace is different and unrealistic. If we look at Northern Ireland, for example, what would you say to that?
I would say that they're not correct. Let me make a comparison in the historical context of Israel itself. After the 1973 war with Egypt, public opinion was incredibly hard. I mean, it was almost inconceivable that there would be a peace agreement with Egypt. It took, political leadership that 4 years later, there was a peace agreement with Egypt after a Sadat moment. It's always very difficult in the midst of conflict to see that there is a way out. But actually, it's a question of enlightened self-interest. And for us, in the coalition, we are a coalition of pragmatic leaders. We're not dreamers. We're not hopeful, optimists. We are realists, but we are possibilists who understand the complexity today of the trauma, the fact that there is complete lack of trust between the two societies. But that as a security doctrine that only relies on force has clearly not worked. The only way forward today is actually a political solution that is anchored in realizing the right of both people. But also, realistically speaking, if you ask people about their support to a two-state solution, on the Palestinian side, the latest polling shows us it's at 71%. In Israel, it's less than a third of the population. That is a difficult thing to imagine that there would be a political solution. But the reality is when you put a package to the Israeli public, and this is what many of our partners are working on and looking at polling, a package that includes a non-militarized Palestinian state, that includes a regional normalization framework, a new regional political and security framework that ensures the integration of Israel within the region, that creates a counter to also the regional threats of Iran and its proxies, and ensures the integration of Israel in the region, you see support reaching a majority. And I'm sure my Israeli partner here, Gil Morciano, because Mitvim does a lot of work on this, he's very well positioned to answer your question about the realism of this as well on the Israeli side.
Excellent. Thank you. Gil?
Yeah, no, I think that, when we discuss the current situation, we can speak about the fact that there's no question that we are swimming against the tide, both our organization, this coalition. I wouldn't even say swimming against the tide. We are more like standing on the bottom of the Niagara Falls when it comes to dealing with the opinions and the mindset of both societies after 7th of October. But, maybe we should start thinking about what we mean when we say peace. For our listeners, and I think most of us, when we think about peace, very Oslo days, it was always about historical handshakes, brave moments, top-down peace process and so on. And I think slowly but surely we are moving a little bit more into the understanding. Iba mentioned the damaging effect of preserving the status quo, that we are talking about what can be defined as peace of no choice, meaning that we are not under the illusion that trust could be regained or that we are in some great harmony, great conditions of harmony to promote the two-state. But the implications of not moving there for both societies is so disastrous. It's so catastrophic. And I would say there's another interesting thing that kind of doesn't work against us, maybe even for us. And it's the fact that especially after the war in Iran, but definitely after 7th of October, there's a new sense of urgency among regional actors and international actors, among Arab states, such as the Saudis and Emiratis, Egyptians and Jordanians, but also major international actors. Australia, I think, is an important part of this coalition. An understanding that what happens in Gaza doesn't stay in Gaza, that the shock waves of the conflict in Gaza affects the Arab Gulf and all the way to the Bondi Beach, unfortunately, as we experience. So this new commitment on that level is quite interesting. So if I'm trying to find a way, and I think that's what makes Hiba and I unique in this case, we are dealing with what could actually create a change on the political landscape.
Before I ask you what the roadmap to peace actually entails, do you think that both societies, both the Palestinians and Israelis, have to be so exasperated and reach a point where they can finally implement what you call peace of no choice? Or do you think now is the right time for it? Or do you think that could have happened before?
Think there's something called ripeness, put forward by a guy named Zartman. It's a point where you suffered enough that you understand the continuation of the status quo is not your interest. And I think Israelis in the last 2.5 years They had a real experience of what it's like to live under a full-fledged right-wing government. And the implications is direct, real fatigue. And then Israelis looking around. Heba mentioned here the polling in the Palestinian side. After all those horrible 2.5 years, Hamas is still there in Gaza. Hezbollah is still there in Lebanon. Yes, weakened, but still there. Iran, some would say, and I would agree with them, that we were better off before this war started. And what they really experience is the limitation of power. This illusion of peace through strength that Netanyahu promoted. This illusion that you can reshape the Middle East through military force alone. So when we speak with Israelis today about rethinking security, security still is going to be the major, and for obvious reasons. It's going to be the first, second, and third priority in the coming elections, in the mindset today. But what does it mean, security? What does it mean, long-term security and deep security? Heba mentioned the support for two states in the Palestinian side. When you ask Israelis about the two-state solution, yes, maybe a third would support it, right? The same amount of people who support annexation, right, of the West Bank. But when you ask Israelis, and we saw that in our last poll, you ask them whether or not they support a package that includes, word by word, the establishment of a demilitarized Palestinian state if it's part of regional normalization with the Arab world, and the dismantlement of Hamas. 55% of Israelis support it. So what do we have here? Is it a schizophrenia? Maybe. It's not the first time you will see split identity in the Israeli society, but it might be that Israelis don't have an ideological problem with the two-state solution. They just don't believe in the feasibility of that solution. So this is our task, to present a tangible plan.
Dr. Marciano, I can see here that there's a statistic from the Jerusalem Post that 75% of first-time voters from Israel identify as right-wing. How can you wrestle with that?
Well, let me tell you this. From the 55% of people that I just mentioned that support the demilitarized Palestinian state, 62% of them define themselves as right or center-right. There's something very interesting in those definitions of left and right. If you remember, not so long ago, Netanyahu came on stage and had his famous Super Sparta speech, where he basically asked Israeli for more sacrifice, called for the Israelis to accept splendid isolation of some sort, right? To kind of develop our own. And I think today, when you look at those surveys, and it's not just my survey, we need to be very suspicious about surveys, you know, they're like holy verses. You can justify whatever you want with them, basically. But you see a trend in polls that shows you a separation not between right and left anymore, but between, I would call it, Spartans or super Spartans and the rest. You know, those who still believe that through military force alone you can achieve strategic results, and those who are willing or even have the sense of urgency to examine. I'm not talking about going back to the negotiation table, but at least examine different pathways, diplomatic pathways in Gaza, in Lebanon, in Syria, and even in the West Bank.
Kate, have you lost faith in the Israeli government?
I haven't lost faith in the Israeli government per se. I have shifted my faith to civil society. I believe that actors within civil society have the ability to really make a change in what we can see in Israel, and that in many senses, many of the actors within civil society that the New Israel Fund is supporting are playing the role of a shadow government. They're filling the spaces that the Israeli government can't or won't fill, and maintaining prospects for democracy, maintaining prospects for a two-state solution, and maintaining humanity between Jews and Palestinians today in Israel and Palestine.
And do you see that as an advantage, having these sort of peer-to-peer initiatives as opposed to a career diplomat, as opposed to a career politician, you know, someone in Benjamin Netanyahu's administration?
I think they all need to work together. That's the definition of a strong democracy. Governments do what they want to do. They're passing policy, but it's the role of civil society to be feeding them with good ideas, and it's the role of diplomats to continue the channels of conversations and negotiations between countries to reach clever and sustainable and safe solutions.
I mean, Mario, on this one as well, I think it's important to keep in mind that today and for the past years, post a period of, suspension of coordination between Israelis and Palestinians, there are no formal channels of communication, of negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians. And in the absence of these, it becomes really the responsibility of committed leaders from both sides, whether they come from civil society, whether they come from, you know, former diplomats and former ambassadors or current members of Knesset or security leaders, current former security leaders. This is where, for both sides, to come together and almost form a shadow negotiating team, to reopen channels, to actually understand what remains to be the common grounds, where can we move pragmatically forward in a way that actually satisfy the security needs and fears and concerns on the Israeli side, but also satisfy on the Palestinian side the desire for self-determination and safety and security, which is very, very real. And this is what we're trying to do, both as a coalition that brings together leaders who are not grassroots. These are grass tops. It's people with influence. It's business leaders and security leaders and politicians and current active members of Knesset and others who are coming together to say, how can we break this cycle, this vicious cycle that keeps us trapped in a paradigm of escalation dominance, that keeps us trapped in a perpetual state of war, and move into an arrangement, a political settlement that is anchored in realism, that both guarantees Israelis' security requirement and at the same time the right of both people for self-determination and independence. And today there is an opportunity, Mariel. The opportunity is around the fact that the whole region is mobilized. The war in Iran has also laid bare how the region is interconnected by vulnerability, more than it is interconnected by cooperation today. So there is growing realization that we need to shift this reality in the region, because it is sending shockwaves across the globe in energy prices, through trade route disruptions, in food insecurity in developing countries, but then in inflation in developed countries as well, as much as it's affecting less fortunate countries. And that requires, at the heart of stabilizing the whole Middle East, remains the key fault lines, which traditionally has been instrumentalized by insidious actors, including Iran and its proxies, to fuel radicalization. And that is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. As long as this conflict is not resolved, there will not be a sustainable political and security framework that would move the region from this perpetual state of confrontation to a state of stability. And this is where the opportunity lies. I see, and I convene also a regional dialogue platform, which brings also representatives from many countries that have not normalized relations with Israel. And you do see that there is willingness, and it was clear in the statements of many of countries, and Saudi Arabia is one of these countries that made very clear public statements. In the New York Declaration, which was adopted by 142 countries, people mainly focused on the fact that there was a recognition of Palestinian statehood, but people did not pay attention that as part of that, there was clear condemnation of Hamas, consensus that Hamas should not have a role in the future of governance and politics in Palestine, and also an offer for blanket normalization of relations with Israel, which would reset the relationships within the region as much as it is as it's anchored in the resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So we are at an inflection point of opportunity, but also great risks if we lose this opportunity.
Heba, what do you offer the Gazan people that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has not, that Hamas has not? What can we do for them in order to incentivize them to mobilize and have a better future?
You know, Marielle, I think it's important to recognize that the Gazan population continue to be living in tents, completely not benefiting from any source of reconstruction. Close to 70%, according to Prime Minister Netanyahu, 70% of Gaza today is under the control of the Israeli government. Reconstruction has not started there yet either. There has been very limited access of humanitarian assistance to date. It's not fully there. President Trump provided, in the President Trump plan, a framework which created a national administration for Gaza. This National Committee for the Administration of Gaza continued to be in Egypt, unable to enter into Gaza. The whole process is stuck. And yes, Hamas is entrenching and now not agreeing to disarm. And there's a problem of sequence, but the Gazan population are paying the price for that. At the same time, some of the polling is showing that support for Hamas in Gaza is at less than 6%. The way forward here is actually to advance and enable the Board of Peace and the National Committee for the Administration of Gaza to actually proceed, to be able to start.
I want to ask you for all of your opinions on the Board of Peace.
So I think here, the Board of Peace actually provides, within the framework of President Trump's plan, an important mechanism. Many people have a lot of concerns around it. We also want to see that the National Committee for the Administration of Gaza is able to enter into Gaza, is able to deliver for the people of Gaza. There, we have concerns around the dealing between the West Bank and Gaza, but we do hope that within the framework of President Trump's plan at point 19, namely, which actually gives emphasis to the political horizon, that we see a positive movement in that regards. But the whole process today is stuck. It's stuck between the Israeli government not agreeing to start with the process of construction until the immediate disarmament of Hamas, and the reality that, as we've seen from many countries, that decommissioning takes time. The higher representative, Mladenov, has a good plan on the table in terms of decommissioning. The regional countries are playing an active role in pressuring Hamas to disarm, but Hamas is requiring that there is Israeli withdrawal. So there are steps, there's mobilization. The Iran war has shifted attention from the Gaza file. But we need to see significant progress happening on that front, and we need to create a link between the West Bank and Gaza.
Mariela, just very shortly, I'll say that while we are sharing some skepticism, there's a lot of skeptics regarding the Board of Peace, and I'm among them, to be completely honest. However, we do see underneath this very general group, serious people building mechanisms that are answering certain necessities on the ground and creating potential for political progress. And it's mainly about reconstruction. It's mainly about the Gazan technocrat team. So, the idea is to work with it and try to utilize that in a gradual process, in a practical process.
I just want to add, and maybe this is, a really good way to wrap up these conversations, is that there are so many reasons to believe that there is no hope today, and reasons to see why there's a certain population within Jewish Israeli community which is doing their very best to kill any prospects of a two-state solution, or certain elements of Palestinian community who also do not want to engage in those conversations. But what we've seen in the last few days of talks with Gil and Hiba, who have had the opportunity to meet with hundreds of Australians across various talks and events, is that there are Israelis and Palestinians working together on really practical solutions to create a safe and thriving future for everybody who lives in that region. I think it's our responsibility here in Australia to stop and listen to those that are working locally in the region and to hear what they're talking about in terms of practical steps and ways to open up dialogue between unlikely partners and allies, and frankly, to take some inspiration from them. We can get really bogged down in our own local issues, but I have felt nothing but joy and inspiration from working with Gil and Hiba over the last few days to hear about the really tough and real work that is being done on the ground between Palestinians and Israelis to shape and change their future for the better.
Just very quickly before we do wrap up, I'd like to know what everyday Australians like myself can do to advance a cause like this.
Well, first of all, to open their minds, be curious, talk to other people, talk to people whose opinions you might think you disagree with, but learn more, read Palestinian voices, read and listen to Israeli voices. And I invite everyone to come along to events at the New Israel Fund, where we often bring out and are able to spotlight the voices of Palestinians and Israelis that are working together, so that we can see that it is a reality that exists and something that we can all aspire to do the same here in Australia.
Okay, and also I'd like to ask the burning question. We are in an Israeli election year. What happens if Benjamin Netanyahu does get voted back in? What does that practically mean for the roadmap to peace for you two?
Well, in a nutshell, I'll say that, I think that the likelihood that we'll see the same kind of coalition with Ben-Gvir and Smotrich is pretty low. I'm saying it cautiously. But if we are talking about any kind of coalition with Netanyahu, I think one of the major issues would be about the involvement of the international community. Maybe some kind of a connection between the civil society in both sides and the international community to at least try and preserve the resilience of the two-state solution. I don't think we will be able to achieve more when it comes to a repeated experience with this government. But obviously, such a government would have major, major difficulties and major, major implications on the future. I would say the future of Israeli security altogether, not just on the Palestinian issue, also Iran, Lebanon, Syria. And that's why the coming election is so important and so is such a crucial juncture.
Dr. Gil Morciano, Heba Kassas and Kate Rosenberg, thank you so much for joining us here on SBS Hebrew. And we really do wish you all the very best.
Thank you, Mariel.
Thank you, Mariel. Thank you very much.
רוצים לשמוע סיפורים נוספים? האזינו לנו באפל פודקאסט, גוגל פודקאסט, ספוטיפיי או בכל אפליקציית פודקאסטים אחרת.